Thank you, Eleanor. Hi. I am Ramona. I'm the recovering wife of an alcoholic and a very grateful member of Al-Anon. And oh my goodness, isn't this a wonderful place to be on a Saturday morning with the people I love, and I hope the people that will love me. I woke up this morning and looked out this beautiful place, and I said to Bob, you know, I feel like I'm in a convent. And Bob said, I've never been there. I'm so happy to be a part of this 18th retreat at Monteagle. I'd heard so much about it. I've looked forward to it for a year, and now I'm here, and it's a wonderful place to be. There's a feeling here. It's just all around us. It almost takes my breath away. I feel unworthy to even be here today. But maybe you will get a glimpse of what I was, which I'm not proud of, and see what I'm trying to be, which I hope will be better. You see, I was sicker than he was. And he agreed with that. You know, I am an Oklahoma Indian. I'm sort of mixed up at that. I'm a Cherokee registered as a Creek, so I guess I've always been confused. But before I left the teepee, my father said, Ramona, don't cut your hair. And my mother said, Ramona, don't share your blanket. And then I met the great white father. I'd like to take this opportunity to present to you the man that put me where I am today. Bob. You know, this drinking became a problem to me long before it became a problem to Bob. I began to think there was something wrong with Bob. The first, you know, at the beginning, way back, I think maybe drinking was a little bit fun. I certainly didn't say anything against it. Bob talked more when he drank. He was very affectionate when he drank. I liked that. And this was fun. And time went by. And then all of a sudden, there were a few things that weren't funny anymore to me. Everybody else laughed, but I didn't think it was funny. And when the next day I would say something about, didn't you get a little bit too much last night? We didn't discuss that. I talked. He didn't discuss. We lived in the country on a ranch, and the drinking progressed. We had a daughter. This was the first time after this daughter was born that I left Bob over a drinking bout. I took her and went home to Mother. I'd teach him a thing or two. He came. He apologized. He was sorry. I was ready to go back home anyway. So back we went again. This was the first of many times that I left. Our front door became a revolving door. I was going in or putting him out, one or the other. We were moving all of the time. This was the disease of alcoholism in our family. And it is a family illness. We were all sick in our family, and oh, so sick. They call alcoholism the lonely illness, and I do believe this is true. It is so lonely. The alcoholic is lonely, and the mate of the alcoholic is lonely. Because, you see, I had no one to talk to. Oh, I tried to talk to them. As things got worse, I went to my family, and I said, help me. Please help me. I can't stand this anymore. I can't live like this. And my parents looked at me and said, you don't have to. We didn't raise you to live like this. You don't have to live there. Get out. Make a home for your children. And I went back home. This wasn't what I wanted to hear. I couldn't tell them, I love this man. You know, this is what happens to us. We become ashamed to admit that we love. And I was ashamed to say, I love him. So I went back home. It got worse. Then I went to his family. And I said, please help. This is your son. Do something for him. And his mother looked at me and said, he wasn't an alcoholic when he married you. Now that'll send you home trotting. I didn't talk to her anymore. I didn't like that a bit. I didn't get along too well with her anyway, because she raised him. She raised an alcoholic. She said he wasn't. When you married him, it's your fault. So it was a running battle as to whose blame took the blame for this alcoholic. And I had never been to blame for anything in my life. I firmly believed that I could control anything if I tried hard enough. So I tried. My husband had a compulsion, and it was alcohol. And I had an obsession, and it was alcohol. And my every waking thought was concerned with some way, somehow, I will stop this. I'm not going to let it happen to us. Some way. There is a way, and I will find it. So I talked to him. You know, you wake him up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I want to talk sense to you. That isn't quite the time. I would hunt him down at night to talk to him. You know, there's always something you're going to say that's going to change this. I was going to change it. Some way, somehow, I would change it. We had a little boy. Then we had two children, and I was more obsessed constantly with the alcohol. Every day I would get up, and I would think, today, I'm going to say something that gets through to him. Some way, somehow, I'm going to say something. Or I would get up and say, this day, I won't say anything to him. Not a word. I'm not even going to talk to him. And in 30 minutes, I was off on my dissertation. The children. This is the sad thing. And oh, if there's only some way that I can help, some way that I can get a message across to spare the children in an alcoholic family. Because they understood their daddy, you see. Daddy only acted this way when he drank. They knew this. This wasn't Daddy. They understood. The one they didn't understand was me. You see, I could be fixing dinner, and the children would be in the kitchen, and we'd be just happy as could be, just laughing and talking and getting along fine. And Daddy would come home. Now, all Daddy did was just walk through the kitchen. He just walked through and said hi. And I'd haul off and kick the refrigerator. And they'd look at each other and say, what's the matter with Mother? Daddy hadn't done a thing. He spoke to me. And that just sent me into orbit. Because the way he said hi was just enough. You all know what I mean? He could call on the phone and I'd say hello, and he'd say hello. And that was it. I was gone into battle right then and there. I would get up and I would think, this day, Ramona, don't start it. Don't start it. And you know what? I started it. I know what it is to lie and to cheat and not be able to keep your word, because I've done all these things. I know what it is to look at yourself in the mirror and say, my God, what's happening to you? What are you doing? What are you becoming? And know that I couldn't stop it because I had an obsession. And this obsession was alcohol. And it was killing me. I became a monster to fight a monster. I knew no other way. There was nothing too low, too dirty, too mean for me to do if I thought it would stop it. And I tried everything. I joined him. I was the drunkest Indian that ever hit Oak Muggy. Now, I'm telling you, that's a bad note when your daddy's a deputy sheriff. And Bob just thought this was hilarious. He knew I was going to end up in jail. It didn't work. I don't know why it didn't work. I tried. But it didn't. Then the children looked at Mother and looked at Daddy, and they were both drinking. And they shook their heads and went off together and talked. I gave up the drinking. I couldn't out drinking. I made bigger scenes, but that didn't do any good. I embarrassed him. Now, this was a thing. I thought, I will embarrass you so that you'll quit drinking. Now, isn't this confused thinking? It didn't embarrass him, but I couldn't look at myself. Every day that went by, I got more frantic. Frantic. This is a terrible thing, this illness, when you watch somebody you love with all your heart and they're killing themselves and you can't stop it. There was no way, but I didn't give up. I decided that I would teach Sunday school. If you want to know what's the matter with the youth of today, I can tell you. When we're in the worst throes of alcoholism at home, we run out and teach Sunday school. I said, God, I'll teach your Sunday school, and you sober up my husband. That's a fair enough deal, straight for anybody, don't you think? So I taught Sunday school. I was there every morning. Every time the door opened, I was at church. I was at every PTA meeting. I took on the heart drive, the cancer drive, you name it. I became a wonderful pillar of the community. And I taught Sunday school. And Bob drank. So I said, okay, buddy, we made a deal. He ain't sober, and I'm through with your Sunday school. You know, after all, you're supposed to make a deal, you make a deal. So I didn't teach Sunday school anymore. And then I cut myself away completely. Because, you see, then I had no God of my understanding. And this is a lonely place to be, as you so well know. Oh, I had a God, one that I taught about in Sunday school. I had one that my mother had told me about. I had one I had read about, but I didn't have one that was mine. I didn't have one that I could talk to. Because, you see, I really couldn't talk to him because he knew about me. And I didn't want anyone to know about me. This terrible loneliness. You know, I couldn't go to the grocery store in the regular hours. I went at 8 o'clock. I didn't want anybody to know me. I didn't want to talk to anyone. If someone came up and said, well, I saw old Bob the other day, I'd think, where in the hell did you see him? And they'd say, how's Bob getting along? And I'd think, what do you know that I don't know? So I couldn't talk to them. I couldn't talk to anyone, but I talked to two small children. I don't like to think about these things. I don't like to think of what I inflicted. And I try not to carry the burden because I do believe I am forgiven. But I must remind myself that these are the things I did. So that when someone comes to Al-Anon and they're sick and they're confused and they're lonely and they're hurt and they're striking at everything within distance, I want to think, I understand, because there I was too. So I must remember these things, because if I do not remember, I cannot help. And here were two little children that I told them about their daddy. Your daddy is an alcoholic. I guess I couldn't bear it alone, so I asked them to carry it with me, and it was too big a load for a little boy and a little girl. I just have to give you a little example of how sick I was. Now, this was the kind of woman that was the mother of two children. We had horses. We live out at the edge of town. Bob had the horses. We have 2 acres, and I believe 1.5 acres of that's in our front yard. Well, you can imagine what the mowing problem is. Well, Bob figured out the easy way to do that. You just turn the horses in the front yard. Well, this became a bone of contention. You know how we fight at these little things? You know, it was the little things that broke my back. It wasn't these great big car wrecks and all this sort of stuff. It was these little old bitty things, like horses grazing in your front yard. I went to town one day and came back. Bob had the horses in the front yard. They never liked to graze. They'd rather stand under the carport and do you know what. You'd look out the window and there was a horse staring you in the eye. But for some reason, this helped Bob when he was drinking. And he'd sit under a tree, you know, and gaze out, and I'm sure he saw a herd. Well, this day I wheeled in. It was a rough day, and there were the horses. You had to get out and open the gate, get out and close the gate and come in. And I thought, boy, I've had enough of this. This has just gone far enough, grazing these damn horses in my yard. This was my yard and my house. You know, he just happened to hang around there. So I thought, this is it. This is absolutely it. So I just walked in the house, walked in the closet, got down the gun, loaded, and walked out on the porch and pulled the trigger back. And I thought, white man, I'm going to kill every one of those damn horses. I'll get even with you some way. You love a horse more than you love me, and I'll kill what you love. Sanity. Sanity. I didn't kill him. The next door neighbor came over and took the gun away from me. Bob wasn't even scared. He said. But this was what I was. She took that gun and she kept it. And we didn't get that gun back in our house until Bob had been sober 2 years. I get sick when I think what I could have done, because I could have killed him. But for the grace of God. This is what I did to my children. This was the kind of person I had become. It was a Sunday morning. This was when I was through with teaching Sunday school. And Bob took the children to Sunday school on Sunday morning. Very happy to. Now, of course, Bob did his drinking at the VFW. And to get to church, you had to go in front of the VFW. Now, I don't know whether that had any effect on him being so glad to take the kids to church or not, but he would take and let them out, and he'd wait for them at the VFW. Then he'd go back and pick them up, and he'd bring them home. Well, he did a lot of chauffeuring at that time, because I wasn't going out. And, you know, he was going anyway. So this Sunday, he took them to Sunday school, and when he came home, this was a day I wasn't getting dressed. I was not well enough. The burdens of the world and an alcoholic husband were just too much for me. And this was before I had cut my hair, and it was stringing clear down my back. And I had on an old robe about halfway between knee and ankle, old pair of flopping house shoes, and I was walking around the house. This was terrible. And it was terrible. Bob came in with the children from Sunday school, and he was gay. He was happy. He had a nice visit at the VFW. The children had enjoyed Sunday school. And Robin said, "Mother, what's for lunch?" And I said, "Nothing. We don't have anything. Haven't got any money. Fix you a sandwich. Peanut butter." Well, okay. So they had peanut butter sandwiches. And I didn't eat. I'd show them a thing or two. Robin said, "Mother, may we go to the show?" And I said, "On what? How do you think we could go to the show? I don't have any money. You know, big boy over here drinks it up." And she said, "Daddy, can we go to the show?" And he said, "Yeah, you can go to the show." After all, it was another trip to the VFW, and he didn't turn that down. And I said, "Who's going to pick you up? We're 3 miles from the show, and I'm not going to pick you up. If you go to that show, you're going to have to get home the best way you can. I don't feel like it. I'm sick." And Robin said, "Daddy, will you pick us up?" "Well, sure, he'd pick him up. He's agreeable to anything. I mean, after all, he didn't want to cause any trouble. He just wanted to be happy." So off they go, and they start out the front door, and I holler. I follow them, you know. "Don't you call me to come and get you. You know he's not going to pick you up. He never has he? I'm always the one that picks you up. But don't call me today. You get home the best way you can." And I slam the door. And I go back into the bed and cry because nobody loves me. And I don't know why they didn't love me. I was sick. You know, I didn't feel good. Sure enough, about 4 o'clock that afternoon, the telephone rings. And in the little town where we live, the children stand outside the booth at the theater, and they hand them the telephone and dial a number, and the children call and say, "Come and get us." A little girl said, "Mother, Daddy didn't show up. Would you come and get us?" And so I give a 15-minute dissertation while the rest of the children are lined up to use the telephone on, "Didn't I tell you so? Isn't this what I said?" And on and on and on. And she says, "Mother, please, just come get us, will you, please, Mother? Please, Mother." So I hang up the phone, and I dash out to the car. I didn't change my clothes. I didn't do up my hair. I just went. I was furious. And I got in that car and sailed downtown. And all of the parents were picking up their children on Sunday afternoon in front of the theater. And I drove up and stopped. That hair was blowing out the windows. They got in the car, and the little boy laid down on the floor of the back seat. He didn't want anybody to know he was with me. I told them all about, this is what you get. You cannot depend on a father who drinks too much. And back up the street I went, right up Main Street. And I got to the VFW, and I slammed on the brakes, and I wheeled in. And Robin said, "Oh, Mama, no. Mama, please don't. Don't, Mama." And by that time, I was getting out of the car, and she laid down on the floor of the front. And up I went, right on Main Street. And everybody was driving up and down. And I stood out there, and I buzzed that buzzer. And that fella came, opened the door. And I just marched right in, I'll have you know. And I didn't speak to one of those trash that was sitting in that place. And back I went, with that hair just a-flying and those old house shoes just a-slapping. And I just sailed right through that bar. Back through the ballroom and into the poker room. And there sat Bob. He says, "Hi, honey." I'll have you know I just gathered up that little robe just like that. Made me a little pocket. And I rounded that poker table. And I took everybody's money. And then I said, "We're hungry." And out I went. Back through the ballroom. Back through the barroom, carrying my robe with the money just jangling in the front. And into the car. and started home. And when I got home, I was sick. I went in the room and closed my door, and I was physically sick. What had I become? Who was that? I couldn't have done anything like that. What was happening to me? I couldn't stand this. What was I going to do? Where was I going to turn? I was a monster. I had no control whatsoever over what I did. I reacted. That was all I ever did, was react. If Bob said, "I won't drink anymore," I was loving and kind. If he drank too much, I tried to figure out how to kill him. Seriously. I'd have killed him if I could have made it look like an accident. I just didn't want to go to prison. I hated him, so I said. But I was tied to him. I couldn't leave, so I thought. This was what I was. Oh, so sick and not knowing it. He was in his cell, and I was in mine. And we had a wall built between us, and it was a strong wall. This wall was built of guilt and fear and remorse and hatred. And he was crying on his side of it, and I was crying on mine, but we never hurt each other. Not once. Finally, I decided the answer was divorce. This was it. I had gone as far as I could go. So, I filed suit for divorce. This just tickled the hell out of him. This is what he'd been waiting on, you know. He wasn't a bit sad. My parents were pleased. Ramona had finally come to her senses. She got away from this alcoholic, and everything would be fine. And his mother was elated, because she was going to get this boy back that I'd made an alcoholic out of. And everything was going to be fine. And there were two little children that clung to each other a little closer. And they loved their daddy. And they understood him. And they loved me. They didn't understand me. But they were caught in the crossfire. Well, I got a wonderful job. Hours, I was through working at 3:30. Bob gave me everything, mortgages and all. And I started anew. And I had order. No serenity, no peace of mind, but I had order. Because I controlled everything. And it went the way I said. Because you see, I had been practicing my principles in all his affairs. But things didn't work out. You see, things didn't go all right all of the time. And I didn't have anyone to blame. You know, an alcoholic is a wonderful thing to blame. You know, if you can't take a vacation, hell, you drank it up. We'd have had one if it weren't for you. And I've never been to blame for anything. And I wasn't about to become a person you could blame now. So when Bob came back, and we picked up the children on the weekends, and he would sit down and visit a while, and they would say, "Mother, could Daddy eat with us before we go?" And I'd say, "Well, he doesn't want to." And he'd say, "Your mother hasn't prepared for me." And I had. And so he'd stay. Then they'd bring him home. He'd bring them home on Sunday evening, and Rusty would run in and say, "Mother, Daddy's going to take us to get ice cream. Would you go? We waited for you. Wouldn't you like to go?" And I'd say, "Well, do you really want me?" "Of course Daddy wants you." Playing Cupid every minute with two grown people. So, now this really qualifies me. If you've had any doubt as to my sanity or insanity, I will prove it now. He comes and says, "Ramona, now we had been divorced 5 months and 2 weeks. And he says, Ramona, let's have this divorce set aside. And let's make a home for these children, like we should. And I will control my drinking. He told me for 13 years he was going to control it every Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. And you know what I said? I said, okay. So the divorce was set aside. My mother didn't speak to me for 6 weeks. I tell you, his mother was so thrilled to see me. She knew now. She'd been on duty. He'd moved home. She's so glad to get me back. And two little children just hung on to their mother and daddy and cried. It didn't really matter to them, you know. We'd make it. They loved us. That was all. It'd work, Mama. We're so glad, Daddy. So we went to a dance that night and celebrated. And I got drunker than he did. And when I woke up the next morning, I knew what I had done. It wasn't over. Not by a long shot. I was right back where I started. And what was I going to do now? What? Well, I found out. It was taken out of my hands. I didn't have to make another decision. You see, I had made thousands of decisions and never kept one. Not one. I made them every day. I made thousands of them in one day. You know, there's a song out now. Pull my string and I'll do my thing. And that was what I was. Bob pulled a string and I went into one act or another. So when this happened and we went back together, in about 3 weeks, we took a trip. Bob traveled. His job required that he travel, and I went with him. And we had a car wreck. And I came to in a hospital. And there he stood over the bed. And I woke up, I looked up into those big blue eyes. And he looked down at me, and he said, everything happens for the best. And I thought, you son of a bitch. Not a scratch one. And he stands up there and tells me it happens for the best. This is it. How little I knew. How little we know. I didn't know then that man's adversity is God's opportunity. And sometimes he has to knock us down. I couldn't see any other way, you know. Well, I was left with a brain injury. And I was left with something I couldn't control. I had convulsions. And these are not pretty things to see, I'm told. And they're not pretty to have. And I couldn't control them. I had no way. And there were people that didn't want to be around me anymore, you know. It worried them. You know, I might have one of these, and it's embarrassing. I would wake up and not know what had happened. And this was what I had to face. And I became sicker. I finally ended up in a hospital in New Orleans, the Ochsner Foundation Hospital. And I was facing, they thought, brain surgery. And there, in the corridor of a hospital, I found my God. And I saw me as I was. You know, he had given me hands to ease pain, and I had made them into fists. He had given me a tongue to say kind words and ease hearts, and I had crucified a man with it. Because, you know, it is not that that goes into the body that gives all the hurt in the world. It's that that comes out. And I had loved so strongly and so hard and held so tight to me what I loved, I'd almost killed it. And I saw what I was. And it was not good to see. I did not have to have the operation. They told me to go home, and on medication, they thought I would be all right. I got back to our little town, and there was no Al-Anon group. I didn't know about it anyway. But the same neighbor who had taken the gun away from me came to me and said, "Ramona, why don't you go talk to Tom? This is my minister. I think he could help you." I didn't want to talk to Tom. I didn't know Tom. But I needed something. I was ready to try anything for me. I could not stand me anymore. Tom was not of my faith. Young Presbyterian minister. And how again we are directed. You know, these things just don't happen. People say, "Isn't that lucky so-and-so happened?" You know, but we in this way of life, it ain't luck, brother. That isn't what it is. When we give up, and we give out, then we are led. So I was led to Tom. And he was well-versed in AA and Al-Anon. And we started in. Every Wednesday, I went. I'd go in to tell him all about this fella I lived with. And he'd say, "Let's talk about you. I'm not interested in him. Now let's hear about you." He said, "God loves you, Ramona." Well, I knew that. "But he loves Bob, you know." "Well, yeah, I taught Sunday school. Remember?" He says, "That isn't the way it works, you know." Then I knew myself. We took the second, the third. "Let go and let God," he said. "How do you do that? How do you let go and let God?" "This is the way. On Monday mornings, Bob left, and I'd go to the door, and I'd say, 'God, he's your boy. You love him more than I do. You take care of him this week.' And I'd be so happy all week long. And everything would just go beautifully. And he'd come home on Friday evening. And I gave God the weekend off. And we'd have a hell of a mess by Monday morning." I seem to think he only worked a 40-hour week. This meant every day. This meant while he was home, he was still God's boy. Tom said, "Get rid of the resentment, Ramona. You got to get rid of it. Get it out of it." "How do you get rid of resentment?" He says, "You can't fool him, you know. He knows you just as well as you know him. So if you don't get that resentment out of your voice, you're not doing any good, you know. There are three things that don't understand a word you say, just the tone of your voice. One is a child under three. The other is a dog, and the third is an alcoholic." So I had to get it out of my voice. Therefore, I couldn't say anything to him because I had resentment. I couldn't say good morning without being resentful about it, so I couldn't talk. He liked this, too. This Tom was working wonders for me. I'd finally shut my mouth. Bob was glad that I went to this. I read everything I could get my hands on, because I could read without talking. I had to find this God of my understanding, because you see, I had to turn over what I loved the most in the world and take my hands off of it. You know, my mother, I was raised in the country. And when I was a little girl and I'd come home from school in the springtime, mother would have gone to town and gotten the baby chickens. And you'd get off the school bus and rush in the house and throw your books down and out to the little chicken house, because that was baby chicken day. And there'd be mother busy, you know, fixing the water jugs and fixing the little feeders. And the first thing I'd do is grab a baby chicken and just hold on for dear life. And the little thing would just squawk and try to get away from me, but I held on. And one day, mother said, "Put the chicken down, Ramona. I want to show you something." So I put the chicken down. And she said, "Open your hand." And I did. And she picked up the baby chicken, and she set it in my hand. And you know, that little chicken was as happy as it could be. Just pecked, stayed around. She said, "Always remember that. Hold what you love with an open hand." But I had forgotten. The more I loved, the tighter I squeezed. The more I loved, the closer I held. And I had to learn how to open my hand. You see, I was not strong enough to suffer the consequences of my alcoholic's actions. I was not strong enough. So many times when I would get in the car and go get him forcibly, he never wanted to come. I said, "I don't want him to run into anyone." Hell no, I didn't want him to run into anyone. It embarrassed me. But it'd been good enough for him. But I had to become strong enough to suffer the consequences of my alcoholic's actions. And I couldn't do this alone. I had to let go and let God. I had to find a God. I wrote notes. I put them on the blackboard, on the refrigerator. "God loves me." And Bob would come home and think, "She's had it. She's flipped her lid this time." Here they were, all over everything. This was the only way I could remember. I'd read and write it down. Long about this time when I was deep reading, not talking, trying to get rid of the resentment, I got interested in faith healing. You all have heard about this. Very interested in it. So I was lying in bed one night, deep in my faith healing book, and Bob had been out. And he came in and walked through the bedroom, and there I was, propped up in bed about 1 o'clock in the morning, my head all tied up, cold cream all over my face, my glasses down, deep in my book on faith healing. So he goes in the kitchen and fixes himself a drink, and comes back in and sits down in the rocking chair at the foot of the bed. He flips that cowboy hat back, takes a little drink, and says, "What you doing?" Well, you know, this was good. We hadn't been talking, you know, this was no communication, because I had resentment. And I said, "Well, I'm reading a book." He says, "Hell, I can see that. What's it about?" Well, I was just dying, you know. I'd just been dying to talk to somebody about faith healing. But you just don't go out on the street corner and say, "Now, what do you think about faith healing?" Well, he was loaded. And I didn't have any resentment at all about faith healing. So we were going to communicate. And I said, "Well, do you know, brother, there's something to it." He took another little drink. He says, "You think so?" And I said, "I know so." Well, by this time, I'd laid my book down, and I was on my hands and knees at the foot of the bed, looking him right in the eye. And I said, "Yes, sir, there is something to it." Now, I couldn't do it myself. But if I could get rid of all of the resentment and hatred and everything out of me and just become a channel for God, all I'd have to do is just lay my hand on you and say, "Heal," and you'd never take another drink again. "Heal, goddamn, don't you touch me." Ha ha ha.
fell out of the chair. I was just roaring. What if somebody walking down the street could see this faith healing going on? 1 o'clock in the morning. That was the first good laugh I'd had. You know, laughter leaves the family where there's alcoholism. We don't laugh anymore. We try not to feel anymore. We get in a vacuum. We're hurt. We're all hurt. Everybody's hurt. And I laughed. Oh, this is what's so wonderful about this way of life. Laughter. Deep down from the heart, laughter. Listen to it sometime. It's God talking. That's what it is. Later, Bob came into AA, not because of me, but in spite of me, and an Al-Anon group was formed. And I was so grateful to the young man who had led me for a year and a half down the path of Al-Anon. I knew I was home. And Al-Anon is so important to me. It is my way of life. And you know, we in Al-Anon, we feel that to be a member of Al-Anon, you must take part in this program. So many times, we hear of non-alcoholic mates referred to as Al-Anons. This is not true. As you in AA would not like every practicing alcoholic called a member of AA. We and Al-Anon think those who attend the meetings of Al-Anon and are trying to grow spiritually and are practicing these principles in all of their affairs to the best of their ability, these are Al-Anons. And always I hope when I talk that I give you and AA a better understanding of us, the mates, who are so sick. So maybe you can have a little compassion for us. I hope that maybe I talk to the mate of an alcoholic who is not a member of Al-Anon, and they think, I'd like to have this. I'd like to share in this. And I hope that I have given you a glimpse of my higher power, whom I choose to call God, who took me, a monster, and loved me, and gave me a second chance, and taught me how to love. Because you see, I thought I loved, but I didn't. I possessed. But I had to find you people to show me, because you didn't tell me, you know. You didn't say, Ramona, you have to do this, and you have to do this. You said, come walk with me. And you walked ahead of me, and you showed me the way. When my burdens were heavy, you helped me carry them. When my heart had been full of tears, you made it burst with joy. When I had been so afraid, and so lonely, you gave me faith. And this is wonderful. This put me here today. I only hope that I can give to you a little bit of the love you've shown me, because my heart bursts with it. I am so grateful, and I would not have it if it hadn't been for you. I hope I never forget that when our doors open and there comes someone so sick, so scared, so lonely, so hurt, that I can't say, I love you. Come go with us. We'll change that tear to a smile. Your load won't be too heavy. We'll help you. because only through giving to you can we receive. And I've received so much from people like you. And thank you. And may God bless you always.